The following message extends the teaching or preaching ministry of Westminster Presbyterian Church of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America. The speakers you will hear may be our church pastors, lay teachers, or outside guest speakers. Please contact us for permission before reproducing this material in any format. May God bless your study of His Word.
We can begin with prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we come together here this morning. We reflect on the privilege we have of free worship in this country. We reflect on the fact that our church is able to proclaim the gospel here in our region and through our missionaries throughout the world. And Father, we thank you for the heritage we have of freedom and for the ordered freedom that our ancestors gave us as an inheritance that we today can enjoy it. And now, Father, we ask you to bless us during this time that we may gain insights and that the collective experience of what we're learning in this class will bring us to a point where we'll have a much clearer understanding of the role of Christianity in the founding of our country. Well, we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. You'll find the timeline useful from now on. If you're a little rusty, it's been a while since you've studied your early American history in school somewhere along the line. And when I mention certain events and so forth, if you have your timeline, you bring it with you, fold it over, you can glance down and say, oh, yeah, 1774, I see, yeah. The Christian activities are on this one side here, and the political, historical events there on the other. Well, today's class is called The Mitre and the Scepter. It's not a word we use very much in our Presbyterian and Reform circles, but I'm sure you all recognize the mitre as the hat worn by bishops, bishops of the Roman Catholic Church, bishops of the Episcopal Church, the Church of England, the Episcopal Church in the United States, and other churches that have a hierarchical organization where the bishop is the ultimate authority in the church. And so, as we continue on here, we're going to be talking about the mitre and the scepter. The scepter, of course, being the symbol of kingship and monarchy. How closely intertwined they were. In the British Empire of the 18th century, there were two religious groups. First, the Church of England, the established church, whose head was the monarch. Not a bishop, not the Archbishop of Canterbury, but the actual monarch. This occurred from the time of King Henry VIII when he broke away from the Roman Catholic Church. He made himself what he called the governor of the Church of England. It was really an English Roman Catholic Church is what it boiled down to. But subsequent times, the church became more and more Protestant. One could not hold political office, attend a university, or hold a government position unless one was a member of the official established church, the Church of England, also known as the Anglican Church. We'll be using the term Anglican interchangeably here. Now, after the Glorious Revolution of 1689, and you'll recall that's when King James II, who was himself a Catholic and leaning towards Catholicism, trying to think about maybe bringing the country back to Catholicism after the English Civil War and all of that, was chased out of the country. And he was replaced by King William of Orange of Holland, a Protestant. And with the Glorious Revolution, they changed governments without a lot of bloodshed. So after the Glorious Revolution of 1689, only a Protestant could be the King or Queen of England, and that's true right up until today. In 1690, the Act of Toleration was passed by the Parliament as a consequence of the Glorious Revolution. All those who refused to attend the Anglican Church were known as dissenters, or sometimes they were called nonconformists. And these folks, Presbyterians, Quakers, Baptists, Separatists, other sects and religious groups, were tolerated. That meant that they could worship as they pleased, but they were excluded from the various positions that I mentioned earlier if they were not members of the established Church of England. Now, if you were a nonconformist, you worshipped at a meeting house. And if you were a member of the Church of England, you worshipped at a church. In fact, here in early Pennsylvania, the Presbyterians, the Quakers, and others all called their places of worship meeting houses. And the Presbyterian Church has only been in more recent years that we refer to our places of worship as churches. But during the early period, church meant you were an Anglican. Meeting house meant that you were not. Thus, a Quaker meeting or a Presbyterian meeting was a common sight in England as well as the 13 colonies. Well, from the Act of Toleration, for 85 years, until the outbreak of fighting in New England at the time of the Revolution, there was a struggle in the colonies to resist the establishment of the Church of England in America, and especially the seating of an Anglican bishop. This became quite a contentious issue. As you could imagine, the descendants of the Puritans and the Covenanters and so forth were not interested in seeing the Church of England established in the colonies. There was a great debate over mitre and scepter in the pulpit and in the press. The Anglicans aimed at the complete reordering of American society, while the High Church Anglicans were dedicated to monarchy. The nonconformists tended towards republicanism, as we've learned with the Puritans and the English Civil War. The descendants of the Puritans and the Covenanters, that would be the Scots Presbyterians, feared losing religious liberties that their forefathers had won for them. In New England, the numerically superior Congregationalists saw the few Anglicans in their midst as aspiring to power and continuing to have their church established with a bishop at its head. There's an interesting chart here I want to show you. It shows you the strength of the various denominations at this time period. 1776, at the time of the Revolution, and this is of all religious adherents in the colony. So if we take everybody who worshipped, everybody belonged to a church, everyone who was a Christian, this is what percentage of that group each denomination was. So the Congregationalists made up 20.4%. The Episcopalians, by the time of the Revolution, had moved up to 15.7%. And this was largely in the South, but also to some extent in the middle colonies. The Presbyterians, 19% of all those adherents. The Baptists were coming along and at 16.9%, almost 17%. The Methodists had hardly gotten started here in America. They're only 2.5%. Methodists did not play a significant role during the Revolutionary period, but they dramatically increased afterwards. And Catholics, 1.8%. Catholics were a very small group. And you have a group of Congregationalists, Presbyterians, and Baptists that make up a significant portion of the Protestant churches at this time. So that's where we stand as we move into our lesson today. For 85 years, church and state was the most familiar issue before the colonial public. Carl Bridenbaugh, whose book, Mitre and Scepter, provided the title and much of the content for this lesson, has this to say. And by the way, his book is on the bibliography if you're interested. It's out of print, but I got it on Amazon Used Books very easily, got a copy, if you're really interested. Quote, "It is indeed high time that we repossess the important historical truth that religion was a fundamental cause of the American Revolution." Something we've talked about before. This distinguished-looking gentleman is Ezra Stiles. He is a congregational minister from Rhode Island. If you have a good memory, you may remember last week I said that Dr. Witherspoon, John Witherspoon of the College of New Jersey, later known as Princeton, and Ezra Stiles were cooperating, trying to coordinate right before the revolution broke out. On April 23rd, 1760, Ezra Stiles, pastor of the Second Congregational Church in Newport, Rhode Island, preached a sermon entitled A Discourse on Christian Union. This sermon, which was printed and widely disseminated, is a key to seeing the issues facing nonconformists or dissenters versus the designs of the Anglicans. Stiles said that it was a time for coming together of the different denominations who had been split by the Great Awakening, beginning in the middle of the 18th century, George Whitefield, Jonathan Edwards, and the churches had split over the Great Awakening. And he said, it's time for us to get back together again. Among the Congregationalists were the Old Lights and the New Lights. The New Lights were those who went along with the evangelical work of the Great Awakening. The Old Lights were those who tended to resist it. Among the Presbyterians, you had the Old Side and the New Side. And in fact, they had split so completely, there was an Old Side Synod and a New Side Synod. The Old Side Synod was in Philadelphia, the New Side Synod was in New York. Well, they came together in 1758 to form a joint synod of Philadelphia and New York. Gilbert Tennent, you may recall, from New Jersey, had done a lot to create this split with his sermon on an unconverted clergy. He went around criticizing pastors who he felt were not really born again. He later, as time went on, regretted taking such a harsh stand and was one of those who helped to bring the denomination back together again. And that was in 1758, and they formed this joint synod of more than 100 Presbyterian pastors and their churches in the Middle Colonies, Maryland, and Virginia. And you recall the film on the Scots-Irish, how they spread down from Pennsylvania through Maryland into Virginia and the Carolinas. Stiles preached that universal Protestant liberty could be achieved by means of a union of the Reformed churches within the colonies. With a union, he didn't mean that they would each give up their distinctive beliefs. In other words, Congregationalists didn't have to become Presbyterians, and Presbyterians didn't have to be Congregationalists, but that they could work together as groups and not be separate from each other and work in a collective way to protect their freedoms in the colonies from this assault by the Anglican Church. Archbishop Thomas Secker, in 1763, this would be the Archbishop of the Church of England, learned about the threat posed by Stiles' quote, intention to unite all parties and sects in the country to unite against the Church of England. The discourse on Christian union proved to be but a prelude to the furious debate during the 1760s over religious and civil liberties. Rittenbaugh comments, quote, the ideal religious liberty was a powerful factor in the remarkable change of mind that caused Americans to revolt against Great Britain. Anglican bishops became the principal symbol in the American mind of the threatened ecclesiastical tyranny. The American Revolution of 1760-1775 resulted quite as much from a religious as from a political change in the minds and hearts of the people, unquote. It was John Adams who said, if you recall, that the American Revolution was not the war for independence. War for independence began in 1775 and continued to 1783. But the American Revolution was the change in the hearts and the minds of the American people, which caused them to take up arms against the British and declare independence. And part of that reason for their wanting to do that was this threat to lose their religious freedoms. Britain was victorious over France in the Seven Years' War, called in the United States the French and Indian War. When this was concluded in 1763, victorious Britain set about reorganizing its empire. A mounting conviction in the public mind concluded that civil and religious liberties were no longer safe The consequences of this conviction ultimately would be the Declaration of Independence and the 7 years of fighting that came after it. For a long time, all activities of the Church of England in the colonies came under the jurisdiction of the Bishop of London. In 1699, the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel, SPG, was established. And this is the vehicle by which the Anglican Church wanted to establish itself in the 13 English colonies. All Anglican priests sent to the colonies were considered missionaries under the supervision of the SPG and the Bishop of London. And the colonists were getting kind of nervous because in Cambridge, just outside of Boston, where you know Harvard University is today, they built this large, for that time, large mansion house. It was built, in fact, in 1748 by Thomas Sherlock, Bishop of London, and there was a report going around saying that it was being prepared should he send out a bishop to the colonies to complete the establishment of the Church of England. This would be the bishop's palace, as they called the home of the bishop. So it's not really a palace, but by colonial standards it was a large home. There was talk that the first Anglican bishop was going to be housed there. The elegant house was erected in 1761 by the Reverend East Apthorpe, an Englishman who came to America, a wealthy man, who was an Anglican clergyman. And it quickly became a symbol of episcopal magnificence in America. You remember when we talked about the Bible and the Revolution last week, we talked about Reverend Jonathan Mayhew and his sermon. We looked at that sermon last week, as well as one by John Witherspoon. It's in this context, this time period, that the Reverend Jonathan Mayhew preached his sermon, a discourse concerning unlimited submission and non-resistance to the higher powers. We did discuss that in some detail last week. Mayhew preached that, quote, "People have no security against being unmercifully priest-ridden, but by keeping all imperious bishops and other clergymen who love to lord it over God's heritage from getting their feet into the stirrup at all. Rulers have no authority from God to do mischief." In plain English, there seems to have been an impious bargain struck up between the scepter and the supplice in enslaving both bodies and souls of men, unquote. So you could say the mitre and the scepter, or you could say the scepter and the supplice. The supplice, of course, was the outer dress of a priest. So he was simply saying that this close connection between the monarchy and absolute government and priests and the bishops of the Episcopal Church were tightly connected. You get one, you kind of get the other automatically. Now, we remember back in one of our earlier lessons, King James I was not a friend of the Puritans at all. He did support the established church. He was not a Roman Catholic. He was a sincere Anglican. And the Anglican reply to Mayhew was, "The fall of the crown is never any further distant from that of the mitre, and therefore the good old saying, 'No bishop, no king,' however grating it may seem to some people, ought to be the standing maxim of the English government." Some Anglicans called Mayhew a swaggering bully, a vain and arrogant quack doctor. I'm not sure why you'd call someone a quack doctor, but anyway, that's what they called him. And you remember, during the period of James I, that's what he said. No bishop, no king. He thought that you had to have an episcopal structure in the church to support the monarchy. That's why he didn't like the Puritans or the Presbyterians, as a matter of fact. Even though he'd been raised as a Presbyterian in Scotland, once he got to England, he embraced the Anglican Church as supporting monarchy. He and his descendants all lean towards absolute monarchy, total control, without a parliament, without any breaks, without anyone else having anything to say about the government except the king. And that would be going backwards as far as the English were concerned. failure to secure an American episcopate in the 1750s left the SPG, Society for the Propagation of the Gospel, missionaries in America bitter and frustrated. Their first attempt was not successful. And why was that? Because Parliament was controlled by the Whigs, and you have this division between the Whigs and the Tories. The Tories were the king's and the church's party in the Parliament, and the Whigs were what we would call classical liberals, not liberals that we think of today when we talk of political liberals. But these liberals, in an earlier meaning of the word liberalism, were in favor of freedom of expression and other similar ideas. The Whig government supported the dissenters and the nonconformists, who made up a good portion of their voting bloc in England, and so the idea of establishing the bishop was put down. The contest for ecclesiastical dominion of America intensified with every decade after 1690, as both parties worked out and clarified their positions. Now, here's our friend John Calvin, going all the way back to the 16th century. The Puritans, as we have seen, brought with them a well-developed understanding of their past. The New Englanders shared in the common international heritage of Calvinism, which stretched back from England to Geneva. All were Protestants against the Church of Rome, and an anti-Catholicism was a staple of their religious diet. Now, as you know, there was intense persecution of the Protestants during the Reformation by Catholics. We think of Bloody Mary, Mary the First in England, who persecuted the Protestants viciously. She burned more than 300 at the stake, and the Marian exiles went to Geneva and stayed with Calvin, as you know, and learned all about the Reformed faith there. So they had this heritage, and they were well aware of their history. In America, the Church of England loomed ever more threatening to the dissenters. Though still inferior to numbers to the Presbyterians and Quakers in the middle colonies and the Congregationalists in New England, Ezra Stiles said the Episcopalians had grown from a handful in 1690 to 12,600 worshiping in 47 churches under the care of 27 missionaries by 1760. Now, the colonists began to show their concern in a variety of ways. We're going to look at several political cartoons today. This is, if you look at it carefully, is a half-soldier, half-priest. There's some interesting things here about the cartoon, which you can't see too well. You can see some writing and things here, but you can see the main image. And the blending together of the Episcopal priest and the British soldier gave a certain idea of, we will rule you with force if we need to in order to establish the kind of government and the kind of church that we would like to see you have. Now, for example, there is a slogan here in Latin, which my wife was happy to help me with, and it's in hoc signo vincetimus. In hoc signo vincetimus. Do you know what famous figure in early Christian history said that? Any of you? Constantine. By this sign, we will conquer. Remember when he had the vision of the cross, Constantine, the Roman emperor? And after he became the emperor, he made Christianity legal in the Roman Empire. No more persecution. And so the same idea is here. In this sign, we will conquer. Another one here says, woe to thee, Boston. Sword, go through the land. Another one, down here, you see the ecclesiastical canon, it says right here. Ecclesiastical canon. And on the canon, it says, alliance between church and state. And over here on the shield, it says the 39 Articles. And if you're familiar with the Anglican Church, you know the 39 Articles are their basic confession. Like, we have the Westminster Confession, they have the 39 Articles. And so, this was a critical image of the kind of thing that the colonists were becoming increasingly upset about. Now, Alice Baldwin, this is another book that's on your bibliography, Her book was written some years ago, but it's been reprinted in a new edition. Alice Baldwin, in her book, The New England Pulpit and the American Revolution, said, quote, "The congregational divines had made the word bishop stand for everything hateful in the Yankee past," unquote. These same attitudes held in the Presbyterians and other Calvinist communities of the Middle and Southern colonies, where many an American picked up more by ear than by printed page, as people shared ideas and information with each other. Increasingly, a segment of the gentry, the wealthy upper-class people in the colonies, drew towards the Church of England and allied itself with the growing number of Anglican office holders who came to America to run the government and to collect the taxes and so forth, newly arrived from the mother country, as the British government attempted to tighten its control over the colonies. And I think you're all familiar with the story that after England won the French and Indian War and the French had to give up their colony in Canada, New France, it was very expensive, and it was a dramatic victory for Britain, and it established what was called the First British Empire, which the Americans, with the Revolution, would help to shatter. But nevertheless, this First British Empire cost a lot. The war costs were dramatic, and the cost of maintaining soldiers in the New World. And so they wanted the Americans to help pay for this expense. And so they wanted to tax them, and it sounded reasonable enough. And I don't think the Revolution would have ever happened if the British leaders were more aware of what was life was like in the colonies and the attitudes that people had. It makes me think of people who talk about our invasion of Iraq under the Bush administration. We were brilliant in defeating their military very quickly and taking over. But then what? What do we do then? And we didn't have enough people. And those who were there have written memoirs now. We didn't understand the culture well enough, the different subgroups and how they worked with each other and the local attitudes well enough to set up a good system that would work. Same thing here. People crossed the pond in England, upper-class people who had these positions of running the government, really did not have a good understanding of how the Americans felt. If they had, and if they had handled things differently, we'd be like Canada. We would have become a dominion, I suppose, and eventually we would have become independent. We would have never had an American Revolution, but they didn't have the common sense to do that. A well-known American historian wrote a book called In Pursuit of Folly, in which he shows the stupid mistakes of the British leadership during this time period. Well, in 1765, the political events which led to the Declaration of Independence had begun. And here we see an illustration of one of the stamp tax riots in Boston. The Stamp Act was passed, and the colonists were outraged. And then they continued on a few years later with the so-called Townshend Acts after the minister who proposed them. The Stamp Act was a direct tax. When you bought things like newspapers and various things, you had to have this stamp attached to it. And you had to pay for the stamp. That income would go back to England. Or the Townshend Acts were trade acts where if you imported things from England, you had to pay a tax when they came into the colony. So it would add to the cost of the item. Now, as we all know with what we learned in elementary school, the colonists' problem wasn't necessarily with the taxes. They're just nothing compared to what we pay today. Most of you are aware we've just reached the point in April where your entire income has been to pay all your taxes for the year. I don't know if you've ever seen those statistics or not, but we just went past that point. So from January up until quite a few days ago, all your income went to paying taxes. Now, from now on to the end of the year, it's more your money. Well, the colonists weren't so much concerned about the amount of the taxes. They weren't that much. It was how they were levied on the colonists. And we all know no taxation without what? Representation, and that was the big concern. Now, John Adams wrote later, quote, "The apprehension of episcopacy, the bishop coming to America, running the Anglican Church, contributed as much as any other cause to arouse the attention of the common people and urged them to close thinking on the constitutional authority of the Parliament in the colonies. There was a lot of violence. You see here people out in the streets hanging people in effigy. When I say violence, there were some attacks on the tax officers, other things like that, but there were big protest meetings all along the colonies in Philadelphia and Charleston and New York about paying. And so the traditional approach, thinking of our very first lesson in this class, is all political. The whole founding of our nation was just a political issue. And this whole class, its purpose, has been to show, no, it was both political, rational thinking, and also Christian. I said to Nancy, I think I'll get a little eagle to wear on my lapel, because it reminds me and you that there's two wings to the eagle, one religious and one secular, which is what this class has been all about. The Stamp Act crisis convinced the Presbyterians, our group, that more than ever they must seek allies if they were to stem the Anglican advance. In May of 1766, 80 ministers and elders attended an annual meeting of the Synod of New York and Philadelphia, the new combined synod. Francis Allison, a Philadelphia Presbyterian minister and a leader in the denomination, brought forward an overture for correspondence with the Association of Churches of Connecticut. The Connecticut Congregationalists were leaning more towards a Presbyterian system, where they would not just be totally independent little local congregations, but they would come together and have something like Presbyterian presbyteries and synods. And so there was a lot of commonality there. And so they approached the New England Congregationalists. Would they like to form some sort of union to put up unified defense against what was happening? They gathered in Elizabethtown, New Jersey, and they discussed this plan of union. Unfortunately, the Boston Association of Congregationalists turned out to be the stumbling block, and they refused to go along with this idea. Now, if you look on the back of your handout, you'll see this 18th century cartoon. It has a lot of neat symbolism in it. What we're seeing here is a cartoon entitled An Attempt to Land a Bishop in America. And here we see the bishop, the frightened bishop, getting back on this ship called the Hillsborough, named after a British statesman, a leader in the British government. And we see him up there. He's praying with clasped hands. Lord, now lettest thy servant depart in peace. Two irate bully boys pushed the Hillsborough away from the Boston quay with a boat hook. On the deck beside the priest is a coach showing the magnificence idea of the bishop or of the Episcopal Church, a fancy coach for the priest and or the bishop, and that's there. And there's even, you can't see it very well, there's even a mitre shown there and a staff, some of the symbols of episcopacy. Ashore, a turbulent mob is assembling. One man flourishes a flag with a liberty cap and motto, Liberty and Freedom of Conscience. Two others have copies of Locke and Sidney on government. These are two secular thinkers who wrote about the natural rights of Americans and anybody, actually, not just Americans, British subjects and so forth. That represents one side of the eagle's wing. The other is my favorite part. This little thing, it's hard to read, this book being thrown at his head says, The Works of Calvin. That's the Reformed Christian aspect of Get Out, as well as the secular ideas about church and state. A sober Quaker holds a copy of something called Barclay's Apology, and a bystander shouts, No lords spiritual or temporal in New England. Near it lies a paper marked, They shall be obliged to maintain bishops that cannot maintain themselves. And my favorite down here is the rat. And you see the rat is even throwing something at the ship. Even the rat says, Get out. Great cartoon from the time period. It's one of my favorites. That's why I reproduced it for you. Now, the great fear of episcopacy reached its height of intensity during the year 1767 to 1770, when the attempt to procure bishops for America coincided with the imposition of the Townshend Acts, Quote, this is from Brindenbaugh. Anyone who ever even glances briefly through the newspaper files for the year 1767 to 77 can testify that hundreds upon hundreds of items of religious import appears in their columns. It wasn't just political discussion. It was also religious concerns about their maintaining the independence of their churches that their ancestors had come to America and founded. And later on, the Scots-Irish, as they had their Presbyterian churches out on the frontier area. They wanted to maintain that. They did not want to have, as they did in Northern Ireland. You remember one of the reasons they fled from Northern Ireland in the film? Is their marriages weren't considered legitimate, their children weren't considered legitimate, etc., because they weren't Anglicans. At the time of the meeting of the First Continental Congress, one Episcopal minister was threatened by a Connecticut mob who shouted, "Down with the church, the rags of popery. Their rebellion is obvious, and treason is common, and robbery is the daily devotion," meaning the tithes that you had to pay, whether you were a member of the church or not, once the church was established. Late in 1772, the Boston Town Meeting voted to create committees of correspondence to state, quote, now the committees of correspondence are a very famous element of the American Revolution. They connected with each other all around the colonies, kept each other all informed of what was going on. But listen to this. When they created these committees of correspondence, this was the reason for doing it. To state the rights of the colonists as men, as Christians, and as subjects. Now, closely related to the issue of Anglicanism, we're going to shift gears now, move off of the attempt to establish the Church of England in America with bishops and tithes. We're going to talk now about Catholicism. Closely related to the issue of episcopacy was the hereditary fear of Rome. As heirs of the Reformation, both the Congregationalists, the Huguenots, the Presbyterians, the Dutch and German Reformed all remembered the persecution of past years when they were in Europe. They had a deep hatred of the Roman Catholic Church. Many died at the hands of the church during the 16th and 17th centuries, during the wars of religion in Europe and also in England. And so they think back to these days, and they're aware of the threat of the Roman Catholic Church to their Protestant beliefs. There was an event that occurred that if you've ever been to England and been there in November, you'll know what they do on November 5th. Does anyone know what the English do, a holiday they have on November 5th, what they call it? Fawkes Day, Guy Fawkes Day, or Bonfire Day. They build bonfires, and they still do it today, like Halloween here. It's lost all of its Celtic cult meanings. It's just children running around getting candy and so forth. Although I have to say that the occult spiritual reawakening in the United States coming out of the 1960s and forward has made something more out of Halloween than it was when I was a boy. I took my costume in my bag, and I walked up and down the street some distance. By the way, no one walked along. No one had to watch me. No one thought someone was going to snatch me or anything. This was the 1950s. And I walked quite a distance with my little bag and got my candy. But after the 60s, more and more this holiday is associated with occult activity, sadly. But the same thing in England today. They burn the bonfire, and they don't think that much. It's just a time for celebration and a lot of drinking, that kind of thing. During the reign of King James I, there was a plot to kill the king and blow up the entire government. And this was a Catholic plot, and it was led by a group of plotters, one of whom was Guy Fawkes, a man with a military background. And they carried these kegs of black powder down under the Parliament House in Westminster. And you know, you've seen Queen Elizabeth open the Parliament, how they all get together, the House of Lords and the House of Commons, and they all get together. She comes in, sits on her throne, and she reads a speech prepared by the Prime Minister. She doesn't rule. She's just the head of state. Well, anyway, these Catholic plotters are going to blow them all up. The plot was discovered, however, and here we see Guy Fawkes, and here we see soldiers coming into the basement area. They caught him in the act. They found who the others were. They were all executed, as you might imagine. And ever after, the 5th of November was known as Guy Fawkes Day. This is the poem. Have you ever heard it before? Don't you remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder treason and plot? I see no reason why gunpowder treason should ever be forgot. And that was a little ditty that went around, and people would repeat. English school children learned it about Guy Fawkes. Catholics were not allowed to vote until the middle of the 19th century as a result of this. They were kept completely out of government, suppressed, and they weren't allowed to have any rights for quite a long period of time. But what's rarely told is the fact that it came to America and it got transferred, particularly in New England, into something else. Instead of Guy Fawkes Day, it was called Pope's Day. And here we have a really nifty little piece of a broadside. You know, broadside was a single page that was printed very cheaply, and you could pick it up. This one had poetry on it, and a little crude image. A little crude image tells the story. What's rarely told is how the festival of Guy Fawkes Night was continued across America, and how in Boston it helped to fulfill the American Revolution. In Massachusetts, it was founded on an anti-Catholic sentiment. From its very beginning, the holiday came to be called Pope's Day. Here's a little description of what happened on Pope's Day. Now, there were two crowds, two street gangs, the North End Gang and the South End Gang in Boston. And the Sons of Liberty were not against using these people in some of the demonstrations and some of the activities, some of them lawless, that led up to the revolution. They got the two gangs together, not to fight each other, but to come together. In Newbury, Massachusetts, Pope's Day night was described. Young men as well as boys constructed a huge vehicle, this thing here, at times from 20 to 40 feet long, 8 or 10 feet wide, and 5 or 6 high, from the lower to the upper platform, on the front of which they erected a paper lantern, capacious enough to hold, in addition to the light, 5 or 6 persons. Behind that, as large as life, sat the mimic Pope and several other personages, monks, friars, and so forth. Last but not least stood an image of what was designed to be the representation of Old Nick, the devil himself, furnished with a pair of huge horns, and we see him right here, holding in his hand a pitchfork and otherwise accoutred it with all the frightful ugliness that their ingenuity could devise. And so they kept alive this concern about Catholicism. And why was this? By 1765, when the unpopular Stamp Act raised its head, Pope's Day became a vehicle for American rebellion. In Boston, competing street gangs mobilized, as I said. And they almost completely rolled the streets for one day. Rather well-to-do people kept off the streets that day. You might get roughed up. By dawn, they had hung from the Liberty Tree an effigy of Andrew Oliver, the British official appointed to oversee the Stamp Act in the colonies. They went through the town, targeting the homes of customs officers, until they came to poor Governor Thomas Hutchinson's mansion. The gangs went inside, destroyed the contents, drank his wine, tore up his history of New England that he was writing. Hutchinson and several of his children in their nightclothes had to escape out the back, run to some neighbors' homes. This was violence that went over the line, of course. Andrew Oliver, the next day, was led to the Liberty Tree. We had our own local Liberty Tree, didn't we, here at Donegal Presbyterian Church. At this Liberty Tree, before 2,000 people, he swore to take no further steps in enforcing the Stamp Act. I guess I would, too. One final thing that really upset the colonists, the Quebec Act of 1774. Now, why all this anti-Catholic stuff? Why am I bringing this up? Because the colonists had fought and died right alongside the British troops throughout the wars with the French. There were 4 colonial wars, and the last one was the so-called French and Indian War, or in Europe, the Seven Years' War. They had given their blood and their treasure, and the victory of General Wolfe at Quebec, where French under General Montcalm surrendered. Both, if you recall your history, both Montcalm and Wolfe died in part of the battle, cinched the British control of Canada. And so the French had to give over Canada to the British as part of the peace that occurred in 1763. Well, in 1774, the British Parliament Remember, this is in the context of beginning to be very hostile to England, and all these demonstrations occurring. The British Parliament enacted the Quebec Act. Canada's territory was expanded to the lands west of the Appalachians, as you can see here. This, in other words, trapped the colonies at the Appalachian level, at the marker of the Appalachian Mountains. And they couldn't cross over, according to this. And this was all going to be part of Canada. Well, so what? Well, here's the problem. It stopped land claims of the colonists in the Ohio Valley, including George Washington, by the way, and it guaranteed, this is the part they were upset about, the free practice of the Catholic faith in Canada and restored a Catholic Church right to impose tithes on people. In other words, you had to pay in whether you were a Catholic or not. This was to placate the Catholics in Canada so they wouldn't be tempted to join the colonies to the south in revolting against England. In the 13 colonies, the Quebec Act had been passed in the same session of Parliament as the number of other acts we talked about, designed as punishment for the Boston Tea Party and other protests, which Americans called the intolerable or coercive acts. Here's another cartoon. This one is called, see the Quebec Act down here? This one was called the Mitred Minuet. Four mitred bishops holding hands in the front form of a cross to show their approbation and countenance in the Roman religion dance a minuet around the Quebec Bill. Four other seated bishops watch approvingly. At the left, three figures direct the dance. Lord Bute, in kilts, provides music with his bagpipes. These are all national leaders. In the center, Lord North, who was the Prime Minister of England, author of the act, points to the prelates on the right. An unidentified minister wears a ribbon, while above and beyond them, the devil whispers satanic suggestions. Paul Revere, a silversmith and celebrated horseman, engraved the satire. He took it from John Greenleaf's Royal American Magazine. Originally, it was used in England, and then Paul Revere made an engraving of it, like he did of the famous Boston Massacre. Now, the Americans were especially angry that the act established Catholicism as the state religion in this province of Quebec. They had fought hard, as I said, during the French and Indian War, and now saw the provisions given to their former enemy as an affront. Now, frontiersmen from Virginia and other colonies, we think now the Scots-Irish, were already entering into this area. In particular, the colonial governments of New York, Pennsylvania, and Virginia were angered by the unilateral assignment of the Ohio River lands to Quebec, which had been granted to them in their royal charters earlier. The First Continental Congress petitioned Parliament to repeal the intolerable acts, including the Quebec Act. Now, the Parliament refused to do this. And, of course, we know the next year, the Second Continental Congress declared independence. By 1775, it was too late, as fighting had already broken out in the Boston area. In conclusion today, Carl Bridenbaugh, as I mentioned, the author of the book Mitre and Scepter, reflects that, quote, "There appears to be little doubt that if the American Rebellion had been suppressed, not only the dispatch of bishops, but the establishment of the Church of England in the colonies would have ensued. The great controversy over church and state profoundly stimulated the growth of a sense of American nationality. One thing the Anglican missionaries did accomplish was to draw the Reformed Protestants together years before the program of the British politicians created a similar reaction. In other words, there had been a resistance against the establishment of the Episcopal Church for decades, and of course, just around the time of the years before the Revolution, you have the political events begin to kick in. But the religious opposition had been going on for some time. Republicanism in the church, as well in the state, was the form of government congenial to Americans. So once again, we see how Protestant Christianity played a vital role in the founding of the United States. Next week, we're going to look at the black-robed regiment This is a phrase by James Otis, a famous Boston patriot, who said that the clergy could play an important role in defending the liberties of English people. We'll look at the various ministers, some of whom were chaplains in the war, others wrote sermons, and all the roles that the clergy played in the American Revolution. Next week, when we looked at the Black Robed Regiment, C of M.